I would say, you know, one of the best things about a country like Australia is that we tend not to be overly constricted by ideology. We're really practical people. We've always had to be. You know, this is a massive continent, small population. It can have some of the worst natural disasters in the world. We later found out that 55% of those young people on this list were Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. And here in this state in Australia, less than 3% of the population is Aboriginal or Torres Strait. I think historically, what we've seen through waves of technological innovation is that you can have regulation that doesn't just allow, but actively fosters and supports good innovation. I'm underlining the word good innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we are joined by one of the most influential voices at the intersection of human rights and emerging technology, Professor Ed Santow. Ed is the co-director of the Human Technology Institute, HTI, at the University of Technology in Sydney, where he leads policy and governance programs shaping Australia's and increasingly the Asia-Pacific's AI future. He was also Australia's Human Rights Commissioner, where he championed technology that advances rather than erodes fundamental rights. With that, let's dive right in. Ed, welcome to the Regulating AI podcast.
Oh, it's great to join you.
Awesome. Ed, we have a global audience. I'm sure we have people in Australia, New Zealand, and other parts of Asia Pacific listening in. But we have people around the world. These are policy experts, policy leaders, you know, civil society advocates. So for them who might not be as aware of your amazing work, can you just walk through a little bit about your background? You began as a human rights lawyer, then a commissioner, and now lead an AI policy think tank. Just walk us through what led you to focus on technology governance as your life's work.
Yeah, so I was a human rights lawyer working here in Sydney, and I didn't have a particular background in technology and certainly not in artificial intelligence. We ran an organization which is, I guess, a little bit like the ACLU in the United States. And what became apparent was we were seeing this one specific problem over and over again. And I'm one of those curious people who tends to ask why. I'm sure that was annoying for my parents and my teachers. But the specific problem was this. We offered this free legal service for young people who were coming into contact with the police. And we were inundated with young people who had a very, very similar message. They were saying, you know, I was doing something that was pretty innocuous. Maybe I was, you know, riding on the train without a train ticket. And then suddenly I was being approached by the police, you know, multiple times a day, but certainly multiple times a week. And they were, quote unquote, checking on me, checking to make sure that I wasn't doing the wrong thing. And they experienced this as harassment. So that was the first thing we noticed. The second thing we noticed, and there's no easy way to put this, so I'll just be really direct, was that all of these young people had dark skin. Not just some of them, not most of them, all of them had dark skin. And we were kind of asking ourselves the question, what on earth is going on? And so what we learned, and this is more than a decade ago now, was that there was a program that the largest police force in Australia was running called the Suspect Target Management Plan that essentially used an algorithm to identify who were the young people in the largest state in Australia, New South Wales, who are most likely to go from committing minor crimes to committing more serious crimes. And then they were targeting those, you know, those young people, a bit like those broken windows kind of policy in New York. And what we found was that you know, that system was trained on criminal justice data sets that went back many, many decades, and it learned, understandably but wrongly, that people with dark skin were more likely to commit crime, because here in Australia, as in some other parts of the world, those people have historically suffered a much higher proportion of injustice. And so what that really opened my eyes to was how a system that was not intended to create injustice, was not intended to do wrong, in fact, was designed to be more data-driven, can go terribly wrong and go terribly wrong at scale. And just to give you one last point on this, a statistic, we later found out that 55% of those young people on this list were Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. And here in this state in Australia, less than 3% of the population is Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. So it was going off beam at such a high rate that it was clearly something that was very important. And I could see that there was an important human rights issue at stake.
So this was 10 years ago, obviously, pre LLMs, pre ChatGPT, or all these other things that you're looking at. And then what was that aha moment? Yes, it seemed like the system was profiling certain kinds of people, dark-skinned people, aboriginals, indigenous people. What did you say, hey, this is not right, I need to do something about it? What was kind of motivating you for there?
Yeah, exactly that. So we, you know, we're an organization that had the capacity to run big litigation, and we did. And we got a result for those young people who were unfairly and unjustly caught up in this system that had gone terribly wrong. But what we also started to ask was, well, if this specific system could go wrong in this way, was it a total outlier, or were there other systems that were also going wrong? And subsequently, I guess we found out that there were indeed other systems that were going wrong. And so I guess what that really led to was a journey where we were trying to kind of understand how many of these systems were at risk. And I should also point out that while we were doing that, we also had some really other interesting kind of research and encounters. And this was with people who were giving us the exact opposite message. These were people saying, you know what, our experience of artificial intelligence is that it's making our world better. It's making our world more inclusive. So I've done a lot of work with people with disability, and there are some extraordinary positive use cases for AI, particularly for people with disability, that can have that opposite effect. So I sometimes talk about living in a fever dream. You know, you have these conflicting visions between the kind of true dystopian problem of AI going off the rails, while simultaneously there's some wonderful, wonderful uses of AI as well. So I guess the view that I came to eventually was we really want to supercharge the positive uses of AI, the AI that can really make our world better and more inclusive, while being clear-eyed about what the risks and threats are and combat those.
So obviously being clear-eyed, you know, that this innovation or this transformation that we're seeing has some tremendous opportunity, but being clear-eyed that there could be challenges that you saw. That was 10 years ago. Now with you see where the technology is going or has gone, you know, whether it is in hiring, housing, loans, all those things that are out there. What is your perspective of where at this moment where we are and where we are going? Because on one hand, there is just an incredible opportunity that exists from healthcare to education and stuff like that. But we also have this rush to innovate because AI is now a geopolitical issue too, and we'll come to that in a second, where no country wants to be left behind. You know, everybody wants to be I don't know whether it's number one or whatever it is, and everybody wants to have sovereign AI. When you look at it from an Australian as well as a global perspective, what are your thoughts on that, Ed?
I think you're right. There is this enormous sense of FOMO, or fear of missing out, where companies, but also entire countries, feel like they need to move at a faster pace than they feel comfortable to grasp the opportunities of AI. And so I feel like, you know, 10 years on, or a bit more than 10 years on from when I first started getting involved in AI, we've moved from a position where you could genuinely have been completely and understandably ignorant of the risks. I think people understand those risks now. But instead, we have sometimes something that really frustrates me, which is this sense, well, it's a bit like having a balanced investment portfolio, you know, where you say some investments will pay off and some won't. But when we're talking about the impact of AI on people's basic rights, it's not okay, I think, to say, well, yes, it's doing all these wonderful things, but it's also doing these terrible things. And so we should accept the terrible things because it's also doing wonderful things. We don't need to make that trade-off. Instead, what we need to do is be more competent. We need to make sure that when we are adopting and developing AI, that we do it in a way that is effective, that is well-considered, and that really kind of grasps what we describe as a socio-technical challenge. So there's one part of AI, which is the technology, but AI has always been integrated into systems, and that integration is often where things can go wrong.
So things can go wrong, and you're saying that because this is on our show, we have, you know, policy leaders, senators, members of Congress, ministers, et cetera, et cetera. And the challenge that we always discuss is this innovation versus regulation. And what you're saying is doesn't have to be that kind of a choice. You can have both as long as there's competence around that.
Ed, that's right. Ed, and I think historically, by the way, I think that's true, right? Like, you know, this idea that you either have to be a kind of a cheerleader for regulation or an opponent to regulation seems to me to be quite childish. I think historically what we've seen through waves of technological innovation is that you can have regulation that doesn't just allow, but actively fosters and supports good innovation. I'm underlining the word good innovation, provided that you're also clear-eyed about the risks. And that's precisely what I think effective regulation does.
So, Ed, right now we see basically three major blocks in terms of AI or AI policy, but AI, when you look at, there's the EU AI Act, then we have the US and we have China per se. I'm not downplaying Australia, or, you know, it's got other great, it's got a lot of great things that are happening. I sit here in Washington, and the thought here is that, hey, the European Union's gone way too far in terms of regulation. We are not going to do that. We have to keep on the path of innovation going there. China obviously has a, you know, it's a top-down centralized policy, and they're also heavily going down the path of innovation in their own unique way. What is Australia doing, and what are your thoughts in terms of when you look at these three kind of approaches, which is the right approach? I mean, EU has this risk-based framework. US has, we got to innovate. We just had yesterday there was an announcement for the White House about, you know, the AI frameworks. Innovation happens to be one of the key ones, infrastructure and security being the other. But tell us your thoughts about these three blocks and what's happening in Australia.
I really like how you outlined those three approaches. And one of the things that we're really conscious of in a middle power like Australia is that each of those approaches is highly ideological. So the current kind of approach to AI in the United States is very hostile to regulation. and sees it as a block, a block on positive innovation. The European Union, by contrast, as you point out, takes an ideological position which is much more cautious. And the way in which they've taken that forward is to engage in what's known as technology-specific regulation. In other words, they're saying, if you are using AI, you have to do these things. And then China, as you say, it's also highly regulated, and it's got its own incentives. I would say, you know, one of the best things about a country like Australia is that we tend not to be overly constricted by ideology. We're really practical people. We've always had to be. You know, this is a massive continent, small population. It can have some of the worst natural disasters in the world. We can. It's also got wonderful, you know, natural resources as well. But if we get too hidebound by ideology, we get into a terrible mess. And so I think our opportunity is to be practical and say, you know what, none of those ideological positions on its own is likely to give us what we need to be a successful global competitor in the AI market, but also to give our own people what they want. So what does it mean to be practical? I'd say three key things. The first is to identify where our niche is. We're never going to be able to compete on scale with the massive players, particularly in the United States or China. And so we should find out, you know, where are our existing strengths and really run at that. Which brings me to my second point. You know, being strategic about AI is super important. One country that I've found to be particularly impressive here that gets very, very little credit for it is Germany. I remember when Germany, a bit over 5 years ago, set its big national AI strategy for artificial intelligence. They effectively said this to the world. They said, look, you know, if you're buying a product that is made in Germany, forget AI, but just a general product that is made in Germany, you're not going to buy it because it's the cheapest one available. You're going to buy it because of Deutsche Technik. You're going to buy it because we have a hard-earned reputation for really strong manufacturing, reliability, high performance. That's why people buy German-made cars, for example. They're not the cheapest cars, but they might be the, you know, some of the best-performing cars. And then they said, think about that when you think about how we are going to really make a difference when it comes to AI. So how do you apply that to Australia? So Australia, I think, has a hard-won reputation for being strong on our liberal democratic values. Those are things that are kind of woven into everything that we do. Coincidentally, we're seeing in pretty much all of the kind of major global surveys at the moment that people, when they're using AI, they want to be really confident that their personal information, their privacy is going to be protected. They're not going to be treated unfairly because of something they can't control, like their skin color or their race or their gender or their disability. So these are things that we can really run at, and we should, because they play to our natural strengths. And then the third thing, I think, is we can show how we do this well. And so for us, that means going beyond just looking at AI as technology, but AI as part of a really effective system. Stuart Russell, you know, one of the true godfathers of AI, who I'm sure you know well, Sajay, you know, in his famous Reith lectures a few years ago, what he said was, think about AI as something that will always fail. I mean, it won't always fail, but if you think about it as something that is that will always fail, what you're going to do is you're going to think about it as part of a system where, you know, there's a technological component, and that technological component sometimes will go off the rails, in which case you're going to have some protections underneath to make sure that you get it back on the rails. Now, I think some of the real success stories coming out of Australia in how we're using AI in healthcare, in transport, logistics, even in areas like mining, show exactly that. They're really effective systems-based approaches to AI, and those I think are really, really strong. And they, and to my mind, they show that practical approach as opposed to a super ideological one.
So Australia's carving its niche. You know, as you said, Australia is not an ideological nation based on innovation, but liberal democratic values. And they released, from what I understand, a voluntary AI safety standard and a proposal for mandatory AI rules. How does, for our listeners who are not in Australia, or who are companies looking to do business in Australia, how does Australia's risk-based approach compared to, you know, like the EU AI Act, which is also a risk-based approach? And what can other countries learn from Australia's model?
Yeah, so I should disclose, we were honored to be asked to help develop that voluntary AI safety standard. Mm-hmm. Just go back in a bit of history, recent history. I think in the early 2020s, there was this huge proliferation of AI ethics principles. And they all said something pretty similar. They said, you know, make sure that when you're developing and deploying AI, you do no harm. Make sure you protect people's personal information, all of that sort of stuff. And in one sense, they were great. They were all great. But in another sense, they were a real failure. And we can see this empirically, that the vast majority of those AI ethics statements or principles have had no discernible effect on the way in which AI is developed and deployed. So that was the kind of problem statement that we all started with here in Australia. And so what we were hearing, particularly from the private sector, was that industry wanted practical guidance. No more fluffy principles. Tell us, you know, give us practical guidance of what we can do to stay on the right side of what the law requires, but also what would be good, what it would be ethical. And so that's where that voluntary AI safety standard came in. It said, okay, here are some very, very practical ways to assess whether your system, your AI system, is going to be high, medium, or low risk. Not shying away from systems that are high risk, but if you are engaging in something that is high risk, here are some very practical things you can do to mitigate or address that risk. And so I think what really marks out that voluntary AI safety standard is that it is it gets hands dirty. When I was Human Rights Commissioner, I asked a lot of engineers and people, you know, working at the coalface of AI, you know, do you have AI ethics principles that apply to you? And a lot said yes. And then my second question was always, how do you apply them? And they said, well, you know, I'm a good person, so I kind of just have it in the back of my mind, but it's really hard to apply. Whereas this, I think, is something that actually takes that risk-based approach, which pretty much every major country around the world accepts, but it makes it much more easy to understand and apply in reality.
So people are taking these standards, so to speak, or voluntary standards and applying. And, you know, your institute's working extensively with business leaders also. Do you see an acceptance with these companies, you know, and what practical steps are they or should they take to make sure that they are, you know, following these, you know, rules, this human rights and operating responsibly?
I mean, there are three things that are kind of the most common issues that come up when we're working with corporate leaders here in Australia, but also actually overseas as well. The first is, often what companies want to do is they want to kind of sit under a virtual Bodhi tree and have a corporate retreat for a day and then come up with, you know, a few shiny balls or guiding principles that will kind of apply to them. And in one sense, that's kind of useful in that it at least engenders a useful conversation, but it doesn't actually provide the guidance. It's the same problem as those AI ethics principles. So what we say is be much more specific. Focus in on what your company's challenges are that you feel AI might help you with, which is really another way of saying is focus on AI use cases. Make it so that it's not an abstract conversation where you're talking, you know, at 40,000 feet. Make it super specific. Okay, point one. Point two is the question about governance always comes to us. So, you know, what is the most effective way of governing the way an organization uses and adopts AI? And there's like a huge suite of different options, but I'll just give two examples of a really bad but common way and a really good way. The worst thing you can do is to say, well, AI is technology. I'm just going to hand it to the kind of technology specialist, the CTO or someone like that in the organization, and she or he will sort it out and will come back and kind of update us from time to time. And the reason that's such a bad idea is because AI is general purpose technology. That's the GPT, as we all know, in ChatGPT. And so it's being used in organizations to fulfill really important functions. And so if you have the individuals, the senior people in particular, in your company who don't really understand what AI is, where the opportunities and risks lie, then you're going to perform those functions badly. As we, you know, like to say, the dirty secret about AI, which should be better understood, is that AI fails at about 80% of the time. And that's a persistent rate of failure. That rate of failure has been at about 80% persistently for the last 4 or 5 years. And I'm not talking about in the laboratory, I'm talking about in the real world. It's a real world investment. Mm-hmm. And a big problem is that failure to engage the right people in your organization. So that governance piece is so, so important. And now the third issue, which is something that we've seen particularly over the last 12 to 18 months really start to change, and we're so excited about this, is the question about how you can most effectively engage your workers. We did this piece of work last year, which we ended up calling Invisible Bystanders. And what we did was we worked with three different employee groups. We worked with nurses in hospitals, retail workers, and people, government employees or public servants. And we were essentially asking them two questions. We were saying, you know, can you reflect on your experience to date of AI being integrated into your workplace? What's working well, what's not working well? And the second question was, can you reflect on what you have learned from other or previous technological transitions? And the I can't tell you how fascinating that research was. And I'll just give you one example because I think it's illustrative. The nurses, a group of the nurses we were interviewing, they had this really consistent message. They said, you know, if you go into a hospital, one of the first things you notice as you walk onto a hospital ward is the sound. All of the beeping, all of the monitors that are going off all the time. And, you know, you notice that at the start and you kind of go, oh. But then after having been there an hour, you start to tune that out and it doesn't bother you anymore. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, if that's happening to you, it's actually happening to us as nurses as well. And what it really shows is a very poor technological transformation or project, because those systems right around the world tend to be, optimized for very high rates of error. In other words, lots of false positives. And what that means is that nursing staff tend to go, well, I just can't pay attention to this because otherwise I wouldn't get my work done. And so a lot of those systems just don't perform at nearly the rate that they're meant to. And what they told us is, yeah, we could have provided some really useful advice about how that error rate should be addressed. So what is the rate of false positive that would be optimal? And so we're actually starting to see, we have started to see over the last several years, nursing unions as well as nursing groups being more brought into the tent about how those sorts of monitors are deployed. And so different hospitals actually have very, very different experiences now. And so I think we see something very similar with AI, that employees tend to understand their own kind of domains. They have that, what's known as domain expertise. They can actually provide some really useful advice about how AI can be integrated into those domains, and we should listen, right? Like, companies benefit from listening to that and actually taking on board that advice.
No, I think you made some very important points. So let me just follow on to a couple of things that you touched on. I'll talk about the corporate. When you deal with companies, do you think governance is a board level issue, or as well as at what perspective for these companies that you deal with should, you know, AI governance happen, or should companies have a governance committee and ethics committee? Because I talk to chief AI officers or CEOs, different companies have different things, but from your perch, what do you suggest or what do you recommend for these companies?
Look, I think that the answer to that question will change over time. But in 2025, I do think that there is real utility in having AI specific focus and on governance. Alondra Nelson, when she was very senior at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, I think she did some truly globally leading work on precisely this question. And so where federal departments and agencies in the United States were required to have a kind of a central individual who had responsibility as a kind of a chief AI officer, that was a really important, I think, change. But there's a good way of doing it and a really bad way of doing it. So I'll start with the really bad way of doing it. My colleague, Professor Nick Davis, talks about the kind of AI guru model of governance, and it's terrible, where you have some single person who purports to have the answer to every AI question, even if that individual is truly brilliant. They end up being the kind of the only person who really takes these issues seriously within the company. And we also know that one individual is unlikely to be able to answer every question that is at the mix of AI as well as operations. So that is a common model, but a truly problematic one, even if the problems don't manifest it at every moment. So what's a better model? To us, the best model is a chief AI officer who sees their role as being kind of almost an ambassador within the organization. So what she or he can do is to explain to the various different teams, starting at the very high level at board and senior executive levels, what AI might mean for them. So what are the kind of key things they need to understand about the particular AI use case? How AI might be deployed in their particular area of operations from a technical sense, and then kind of gives them a chance to actually give their own views, their own kind of well-informed position on that AI deployment. Now, when you start to do that, then you're getting a level of engagement across the organization that is much, much more valuable and impactful. And so that's the kind of thing that we really advocate.
That's very interesting. So what you're saying is have a chief AI officer. We have another podcast called the Chief AI Officer Connect. I talk to the chief AI officers of Fortune 500 companies. But you are saying that person, that position, is more of an ambassador kind of a role that works across cross departmentals, working with the board and others. Is this technology that transformative that it requires someone like that?
Well, I think that's such an interesting and subtle question. Yes, I think now, and hopefully no in a few years' time. So I don't think we can close our eyes to the fact that the transition that we're all kind of experiencing now is a really significant one. You know, I'm in my mid-40s, I feel like I've been bathing in the waters of artificial intelligence now for a very long time, but it's really only 10 or 15 years. And that's unusual. Most people are actually only coming to AI, since November, 2022, when, you know, ChatGPT was released publicly. So there is no question that there's an upskilling that is necessary. And so I think we need to see this transition time as a transition time, but we also want to get to a point as quickly as possible where instead of thinking about it as AI governance, we're thinking about this simply as governance, and AI has a component to it. And you know, to be honest, you know, we've done that in other areas of transition as well. When we, for example, if we were having this conversation 20 years ago about cybersecurity, even that term would have been very foreign to a lot of senior executives and you know, members of company boards. Instead, what you had to do is say, well, look, this is about how you protect the integrity and security of the information that your company holds. Your obligations are the same, but the technology is changing underneath you. And so what you need to understand is what those changes mean. And we'll you know, create some new terms. Cybersecurity is one of them that will actually help you kind of understand what is new about it. But increasingly now, when we talk about, you know, the information kind of obligations of a company, we no longer talk about them as cybersecurity only. We talk about them in the broad, and that I think shows the maturity of the debate.
Things have obviously cybersecurity, AI, etc. You focus a lot on the workplace. You just talked about the nurses and you talk about companies. At least I can tell you in the US, there are changes that are happening very quietly in companies, where companies are letting go of employees or not hiring especially fresh graduates coming in, the new hires that are coming in. Is that a phenomenon in Australia? As you said, the population is small. But just if you just look at it at a broader base, this is also a major transformation that is happening, whether you look at it from a human rights, governance, etc. How should companies and countries, because it's going to impact, because the numbers are just the numbers that have been predicted by McKinsey and many, many others are pretty staggering. And these are white collar, so to speak, jobs, and some in some cases entire professions. Think paralegals, think coding, software engineering, etc., etc. So what are your thoughts, Ed, on Australia, just globally?
I mean, a couple of things. The first is you're 100% right. There is a massive transformation on foot now, and there is no question that huge swathes of the working world will experience their jobs change. And some jobs will no longer be valued. That's point one. Point two is there are wild differences in some of the prognostications from particularly economists about precisely where those changes are going to happen, when they will happen, and what will be the new roles that will kind of rise up in their place. I think it was, you know, President Truman in the United States who said, you know, every economist I've ever come across says, on the one hand, you know, the answer could be this, and on the other hand, it could be that. I want a one-handed economist who will only tell me this, right? Will only give me one prognostication. The problem is that the economic predictions are a lot of people just putting their finger in the air, having a bit of a stab at what really amounts to guesswork. And I think anyone who claims a kind of a level of certitude that is better than that is not telling the truth. We just don't know. What we can do is look at history. So most recently in Australia, where we effectively saw a period of deindustrialization in the 1980s, you saw two things happen. One was, you know, mass layoffs. It led to a recession, and there were a lot of people who were deeply, deeply wounded by that, and quite a lot of people didn't get other jobs. They may have lost their job in car manufacturing or in some other manufacturing area. And that was a defining negative experience in their life. So that is something we need to learn from. We need to manage those transitions in a much, much more supportive way. The second observation is that after a period of transition, the labour market stabilised and we're now at consistently very low unemployment. So, you know, even today, the unemployment rate in Australia begins with 3. It's high 3%, which is effectively pretty close to full employment. Now, my point is you have to consider both of those things simultaneously. So, yes, a whole bunch of new roles and employee types will be created, but it may not be easy for people who are in jobs now at a certain stage of their career to transition from one role to another. And so we need to be able to create those new roles, but we also need to be able to provide true support and better than we have historically at helping people move across.
Yeah. So I think what you're saying is transformation is coming. We just don't know the scale of transformation, but we should be prepared. And, you know, it's difficult. And I, as you said, most people don't know how this transformation is going to work out, like many other transformations. Ed, talking about transformations, you interface a lot with the, you know, besides Australia, the region, Asia Pacific region per se. I talked about the US, EU, and the China bloc. Why should the Asia Pacific, Australia have a voice in AI governance? When you look at that region, it is a pretty significant region with high growth potential when you look especially at the Southeast Asian bloc, when you look at Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, South Korea, et cetera, or, and what is happening in terms of governance and policy, et cetera, in that region?
This is, I'm so glad you asked, because this is an issue that I feel very passionate about. You know, our region, particularly as you say, Southeast Asia, but also parts of the Pacific, have consistently over decades now contributed far more to economic growth globally than that would be proportionate to our population size. We are early adopters of technology. We are much more effective developers of technology than we tend to be given credit for. And yet, too often, countries and civil society organizations and even companies in those two regions, Southeast Asia and the Pacific, have far fewer opportunities to have their say in a kind of big policy setting forums and also, I think, in technical bodies like the ISO or IEEE that are setting the kind of technical standards for things like artificial intelligence. So what do we do about it? Well, one thing is making sure those people are invited and offered a seat at the table. I think the French government did a truly excellent job in running the AI Action Summit in Paris earlier this year, but it was impossible to ignore the fact that other than Australia and New Zealand, there were very, very few countries who were invited from the Pacific region to even attend. And that's true actually for Southeast Asia as well. And that should be considered to be totally unacceptable, that you can leave out huge proportions of the global population from such an important event as that. I also think there needs to be a greater level of curiosity of what's happening, you know, in countries that are not the United States, China, or the European Union. I think those jurisdictions and economies rightly get a lot of attention. They should, right? They are driving so much of what's happening in AI, but they're not the only places. You know, there are far more PhD graduates coming out of countries like India now, in relevant areas like data science, than there are in countries like France or Germany or UK, even by some measures, the United States. And so I think it's really good that the next a global AI summit will be held in India. I think that's a very, very positive thing. And I think it's a positive thing for our region, the Asia Pacific mm-hmm. region. And so I think we need to kind of rebalance that focus. It's not that there's other countries that matter. It is that other countries matter too.
Other countries matter too. Ed, just to follow on that point, as you said, Australia has a 3% of an indigenous population. New Zealand has, and the other countries. When you look at AI, 70% of the data it gets trained on is English and Western oriented. How is Australia going to make sure, or New Zealand, or many other countries that have this indigenous population, that the cultures, the tradition, the languages don't get swept aside in this whole transition to AI, because maybe the next generation is not even aware, because the training data is coming in from a Western English-oriented bent.
Yeah. So there are two solutions there that both need to be given equal weight. The first mm-hmm. is a technical solution. So simply by careful exposure of Indigenous languages, for example, languages that are not English or Chinese or the major languages of the world, you can mm-hmm. develop, large language models in ways that are much more attuned to the cultural context of other cultures. So that there is a technical aspect of that, which is really important. It just needs to be done. And indeed, there's some very interesting and positive work that is happening in the Asia Pacific. Japan, South Korea, famously, even Switzerland. Actually, there's some very important work that's happening. So that is the important technical component. But it doesn't end with the technical component. Yeah, we've seen, particularly in the United States, with some of the debate about more inclusive development of AI. You've seen, for example, some groups that represent African American members of the US population go, we're not participating. We're not going to help you develop more AI tools where those tools are experienced by our community as tools of repression. So it's not purely technical. It's also, we would say, something where you go, well, you need to have a proper discussion with those affected communities about how the technology will be used, and sharing responsibility or authority about how those technological tools are deployed in the very communities where you're asking for engagement. And I don't think nearly enough is being done on that second question. More needs to be done on the first question too. The technical question is not solved, but I feel like we're on a pathway there, but we'll never get to where we need to unless we address the second question as well.
So the technical as well as the societal component is very, very critical. Ed, when you look at AI, and you talked about this, it needs massive amounts of investments. It needs chips, it needs energy, it needs talent, etc. Right now, the way it looks like, it's going to be with a handful of companies. Maybe on one hand, you could probably name it, maybe two hands, I don't know. From an Australian perspective, or just from a broader governance, human rights perspective, does that concern you? Because it could be, look at what social media is today. It's kind of driven by a few companies. What you probably think, see, or feel is kind of in their hands. AI, maybe, as you said, is one of the most major transformation. What do you think of this from an Australian standpoint or just overall standpoint?
Look, I do think I'm not someone who goes around saying that the major tech companies are universally evil. I don't think that they are. I think mm-hmm. that they're very big. And I think bigness has all kinds of positive implications. It allows mm-hmm. Them to do things at a scale that otherwise only countries can do. But it has negatives as well. It's not good for any society where competition is so constrained by markets where there are very few players that pricing can be determined by something that is effectively not the market. It's simply by the exertion of market power. And I do think that's an area where the European Union has been particularly strong. I mean, the US government as well. I mean, under the previous Trump administration, there was some very strong action taken on what you know, the US has called antitrust, where the rest of the world talks about it as competition, same idea. It might be too early to see whether the current Trump administration will have a similar focus on that issue, but they have previously. And so I think that that is something that will have an outsized influence outside of the United States and China if there's, I guess, a bandying together of countries where there is literally, you know, no interest for, you know, unconstrained market power to be supported if they come together and say, no, we're going to push back on this.
Yeah. Finally, Ed, I want to talk about one of your favorite, but also is an important topic, is facial recognition governance. If you marry facial recognition with AI, obviously, you know, it becomes very, very powerful in terms of analysis for national security, domestic security for analysis, and just across the board, disaster management, etc. What are your concerns when you think about it, and what would be a rights respecting deployment, which would maybe in retail or public safety look like for you?
So, I mean, I think the first thing to acknowledge is that there are some very good and, in fact, rights protecting ways of using facial recognition. A lot of us are using this all the time to, you know, unlock our smartphone. For most of the major smartphone providers, that's done in a very, very well considered way that actually protects people's rights. It doesn't harm them. And so that's the kind of thing that should be encouraged. And as we see different models of digital identity being rolled out around the world, we are at a critical moment to really support that. So I think what regulation can do is can kind of say, well, look, you know, if you have designed your system in a way that reduces risk, then regulation shouldn't just go, okay, that's all right. It should foster it. It should encourage it. And then I think we should be just as clear on where those risks have not been mitigated. So we know for things like facial analysis, A, that the technology is very, very unreliable. In other words, where a facial recognition system seeks to identify, you know, something about you, like how responsible you are, how angry you are, that sort of thing. We know that those systems don't work very well. And so when they're starting to be used in ways that have an impact on people's legal or other significant rights, then that's a big problem. And I think the law should be very clear in pushing back on that. And then there's a third category of companies where they've basically operated in a way where they've really flouted the law to develop their systems. I guess most infamously, we've seen with companies like Clearview AI, there's been quite strong regulatory action taken against them in a range of different jurisdictions, including in the United States, including here in Australia, because the company has not taken seriously its obligations for data protection and the right to privacy. So I think we do need, you know, effective regulatory action against those companies because, you know, if they're causing harm, they should. But I think it also sends a message, I think, as well to the market more generally. There are good uses and they should be encouraged. There are bad uses, and regulators will really take strong action against those bad uses.
So I think what you're saying is there are some really potential, you know, good uses, and we should just be careful and have safeguards against the bad uses. Ed, I could go on and on. I have so many questions about the Australian entrepreneurial ecosystem. I have questions in terms of, you know, Australia is such a powerhouse in terms of energy commodities. It could become a big player. because energy is a key component, but maybe we'll have to do part two. But before we let you go, we have a lightning round that we do just to make it a little fun for our audience. It's a one-word answer from you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, Ed. So pick transparency or privacy?
Privacy.
Okay. National AI policies or international frameworks?
International frameworks.
Okay. Innovation or precaution?
Innovation.
Okay. Voluntary standards or mandatory rules?
Voluntary, then mandatory.
Make it a little tougher and tougher. Risk-based or principle-based regulation?
Risk-based.
Okay. In your view, is AI regulation moving too fast or too slow?
Too slow.
What is the biggest risk in your view? Bias, privacy, or autonomy?
Privacy.
Okay. And then finally, open source models, they are a boon or a bane?
Boon.
Awesome. Ed, thank you so much. You know, your work really reminds and should remind our listeners that progress and principle, they don't have to be rivals. Good governance can itself be a driver of innovation. So thank you really for sharing your insights on privacy, productivity, corporate governance, the Asian Pacific perspective, the global AI ecosystem, the indigenous population. You know, it's really been so helpful. And for our listeners, if your conversation resonated, check out Ed's book, Machines in Our Image, and the HTI's resources on corporate AI governance. Stay tuned for more episodes with global policymakers, industry leaders, and civil society champions to forge a fair, democratic, and innovative AI future. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and this has been the Regulating AI Podcast. Keep questioning, keep innovating, and above all, be responsible for AI. Thank you, Ed. It's been just a tremendous, tremendous pleasure to have you on the podcast.
It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.